The Dubai International Humanitarian Aid and Development Conference and Exhibition was held with the theme of innovation. I spoke with Dr. Valerie Nimkamgang-Bemo, development worker from the Gates Foundation Emergency Response Team. She manages the investments that support communities affected by natural disasters and complex emergencies. And I began by asking her about the conference and how that had gone.
We had several good discussions at the DHAD with some of the participants, but also participating to some of the sessions. And in addition, we have different out of the DHAD meetings with different colleagues, with different interest people playing on the humanitarian field and different partners. Then it has been busy time. I think it's a conference about network, but also bringing together the different people from the field that have experience. And this year specifically, it was based on innovation. As you know, we all agree that we need to be more creative and innovative in the way we are doing the work. Then it was good to see the different perspective of innovations in the humanitarian spectrum, especially with all what's going on. We need more than ever innovation.
Can you give me any examples?
I think when we look at innovation, people usually look at technology space, but I think we can have different type of innovation. For example, in the way you do partnership. The traditional way is to have like the implementing organization, UN or NGO, going on the ground and doing that with the normal the donors giving the money. But if we are getting smart on innovating of how we partners with different even for example the UAE, they are present in some of the countries like in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, in the Muslim world, and recognize having them not just be about their money, but also recognize that they are present, their relationship are important, and use it also go in partnership with their relationship. And the foundation, the Gates Foundation, did some of that for the polio in Pakistan to actually go. They have they put the money, but also they actually have a good presence and it's recognized, and they have the voice that can convince people that it's not a spam. It's actually important to vaccinate your kids. And this type of partnership, I feel, is innovative. Private sector play a lot of big role. How do we partner with private sector to bring them along, not just for them to give the check, but maybe for them, they have a lot of in-kind, they have a lot of resources, they have a lot of know-how. If we can know some of the soda can get in the middle of more remote villages and we can get a vaccine there, how can we learn and take their experience in action instead of just waiting for a check?
Well, His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan generously donated more than $120 million to polio eradication. That's one thing. And as you're highlighting there, and as he is as well, and clearly with the UAE where it's positioned geographically, working in isolation isn't going to benefit. You can reach more people if you can collaborate. And as you're saying, it's about fundraising, but it's also about skills and knowledge and being able to share that knowledge across cultures and across organizations.
Yeah, I fully agree. It's about the knowledge, it's about the presence, it's about your relationship. And anybody who work even in the industry know that sometimes your portfolio of relationship is as valuable as the cash you have in your pocket. And I think we have not taken enough advantage of that of that type of partnership. You are the foundation, of course, we have the biggest foundation in the world, but our money just go a long way to all the needs around. Then how we partner, how we bring, even one of the example is working with the Islamic Development Bank to bring a little bit of cash money to make guarantee, but at the end it will be loan. And for the $50 million, you can actually have a $4 billion cash to be able to disburse through loan. That these are type of partnership that I think as we start looking at how do we be more efficient to start looking at this type of model, and it's more sustainable than the cash grant going on, because money's going fading.
Money's fading, and it's challenging making sure that money gets to where it needs to get to. There's a lot of challenges across the globe that we're facing. We're looking at refugees, we're looking at war, we're looking at illness, disease, poverty. There's a lot of challenges. Tell me about the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is a philanthropy. As many people or those who don't know, Bill Gates, who have been doing a lot of wealth for over the years through different private, decide to put some of this wealth at use to the world. And with the one thing that all life has equal value, and to also to say with innovation, with a good way of doing, we can actually reduce the inequality and the poverty around the world. But there's a lot of way to be innovative. And for example, four of our value in the foundation, to give you how we are thinking, is about innovation, one of the value, about partnership, about optimism and rigor, because we also believe that the rigor is not just about doing things. You need to have proper data, you need to have proper analytics, because it's people's life. You cannot just go and say, oh, let me try this. You have to have the concrete rigor and argument to make sure that it's actually appropriate, it's actually feasible, it's actually scalable, and it's actually sustainable for anything. And as a private foundation, we are working in different areas. A lot of people, one of the big part is the health, and one of the big part that the foundation is looking at is at eradication of polio. As you know, the polio for many years have been, it's possible to eradicate, but with the last 1%, less than 1%, to eradicate is sometimes require more energy than the first 99% that was needed to eradicate. But we are getting there with the polio. Africa is now free of polio, and we still have only two countries that is having polio. But in addition to polio, you have all the different health work that is going on about vaccine. It's not normal that in a lot of places, vaccination that we know save children's life, a lot of children will not have access to simple vaccination, life-saving. How do we ensure that most of these places where you have poverty, difficult to access, will still have the basic vaccination? Women will be delivering in a good condition. What type of innovation we should look at to make not the, just the delivery, because we know it's failed for many years. But also the livelihood of people, agriculture, most of the poorest of the world, I think 70 or 80% of them are living as poor smallholder farmer. How do we make through what their livelihoods, how do we improve their capacity to actually make livelihoods more successful and deliver, because we need them to actually feed the world. But also some of the things that we are looking at is the water sanitation, but mainly the sanitation. There has been a lot of progress done on the water, but sanitation, a lot of billions of people still not have a place to defecate every day. And this is unacceptable. That is a basic, we see it as a basic things, but it's still not basic for many people. And we know that environment is important, dignity is important, then having a simple toilet facilities to most of the women. And we know a lot of children in part of India will not go to school a lot of the days, because just with the menstruation she will not have access to toilet. And it's difficult. We see it as it's simple think having a toilet, but in a lot of places it's a luxury. How do we make this not be a luxury but a basic right?
Talking to Dr. Valerie Nimkamgangbemo, development worker from the Gates Foundation Emergency Response Team, and she tells me about her work in the humanitarian field. Let's talk a little bit about, well, let's talk a lot about you and your background. So native to Cameroon. Now, you've worked across Mali, Ghana, Nigeria. 2005, you set up an unstaffed clinic after an earthquake devastated Aceh in Indonesia.
Yes, yes, indeed. I'm a native from Cameroon. And for profession, I'm a medical doctor and with epidemiology and public health. And I've been working around the world in multiple countries. I started with some NGOs and trying to deliver health to the poorest people in places where there's really sometimes no access. And I start working really in humanitarian setting, in place where difficult to access in Sierra Leone with the war going on, in DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and around the world. And in 2005, after the big tsunami that have devastated a lot of countries in Asia, I have to go to the response in Indonesia, in Banda Aceh, who, as we know, was the more devastated place. I spent multiple months there to just help rebuild some of the basic infrastructure and help having the health system restarted and people have access to basic health.
And what does that mean, Valerie, basic health in that situation? What might you be dealing with on a day-to-day basis, people's needs?
In that situation, I think we have multiple approaches. First, you have the basic primary health care. People need simple, because they have been either hurt or broken or small injuries. Then the first thing is to make sure that you have that. But as you know, there will be still pregnant women. There will be some still children that will have the health. And sometimes if you don't have infrastructure, you have to start building mobile infrastructure, a small place in the middle where you create a health facilities mobile, where you can give basic health. People have, especially in a traumatic event, you have a number of heart blood pressure, psychologic, basic treatment. And one thing I remember I saw a lot is that sometimes a lot of people were just coming, even if they don't have a physical need, they were just coming to get taking their blood pressure. It was just a way to have a present, a human present. They were feeling just even consolation to just be sitting close to people. Because remember, a lot of people lost, and I saw a lot who lost everybody. They were probably the only survivor of the 20 or 30 families or household. And sometimes they feel guilty that maybe I should have been gone also, while I'm still. Then just providing that presence, that's here to listen, but also looking at the long term, such as, because you need to rebuild the infrastructure. You need health facilities always needed. Women will still deliver. Children will still be born. People will still have the basic health. And I think you have to look at the immediate needs at the beginning. What are the immediate needs of people with injuries, with consolation, psychosocial, women and thing. But you also have to, like, how do you reconstruct the infrastructure for the long term? That will be safer because it's an earthquake zone, in the way that will be safer than before. And the way that you look at also the local infrastructure, you have to work with the local, because Indonesia
culture,
the local infrastructure, the local staff, because a lot of them, you have doctors, medical, you don't need to have a lot of external because they have that. But how do you even give them the confidence? Because even for them, they lost a lot of their staff. They lost half of one hospital lost half of their staff. They were still in the grieving for all that. Then is be present. I think the more important, it's nice to feel that there's some people care, who are there with us, who are there to support us, to help us rebuild. In addition to give them resources, technical supports, but also just help them in whatever they feel to help them rebuild stronger.
You're also a board member for the Global Health Council and the FETSA Institute Advisory Council for Health Professionals. Just explain a little bit about those bodies or the role that you play within those bodies.
The Global Health Council is really the place where we try to look at the global health issues around the world and bring around the rest of the world to think about what are the critical issues that's going on. How can we share the experience? Because sometimes a small place can be innovating, but we don't know, and we try to do the same and go through the same. How do you share your experience? How do you share what you have been learning, your challenges, but also your experience with others, so that instead of replicating the same issues and the same problem, we can actually learn from each other, share, but also bring alive the big issue that we are dealing. And I think this was when I got to the Global Health Council, at that moment it was a lot more US-based. And at that moment, I was not living in US. Now I live in US, but at that moment, and they were having the board mainly US-based people, and they realized that we need a different voice. We need somebody who's coming from the South, who's living the South, who worked there, to bring that perspective, because we can be at the board. But if you don't have the real thing going around, this is difficult. Then that is how they brought me around. And I think I came with that perspective from the ground, from the know-how, from my family, from my friend, from where I was working on the field. And this was a really good experience, because it's the start value, and this was valuable at that moment to bring that perspective. With the Fetzer Institute, it was really interesting, because Mr. Fetzer, who died, who was a philanthropist, also realized that the big part of life is about love and forgiveness. And then if in anything that we're doing, love and forgiveness should be part of the thing, and it will solve a lot of issues. Then they brought a different profession around the world, and different people from different profession, to look at what does that mean in the profession, in your profession. And I was part of the health profession, and we have people from around the world of different experience, and we realize that sometimes in the health, just the same information, if you say to somebody, okay, you have a cancer, okay, there's a paper there, there's people to get it, this is treatment. There's two different ways to pass even information to a patient. You can have, it's not just about love, compassion, the way you express it, the way you, because it's life and death. How as a medical doctor, as a doctor, you treat your patient, how you be compassionate, how you be present, how do you even listen to the patient and not just seen as a transaction? And I think we usually forget about it a lot, and we have to forgive ourselves also. And we saw a lot of nurses who live in the end of life that people try to get, but you feel like hopeless. How do you forgive yourself? And I think this was a really good experience to start learning about what does that mean to be the love and forgiveness in what we do in the day to day. And this can be a big finish. And one thing that we realize that is, in the developed society, we stand to see the health as a doctor and patient. But in a lot of places, especially from where I'm coming to Africa, the health is the question of everybody. And we actually recognize that actually the health is not just about the doctor, it's the how your family, the community, and actually maybe as the world evolves, we should go back to this principle that when you are sick, you have more chance to get better if you are surrounded by loved one who understand. Your husband is there, your children is there. If you have a support of community, you are better off than just having your drugs and the patient and the doctor. And I think these are some of the simplicity of life, but we tend to forget about that health is everybody's work, and we should look at it as a more comprehensive health. And prevention is important. How do you take care of yourself? How do you eat? How do you look at your family? How you look at your surrounding and the people working with you? Sometimes just acknowledging somebody struggling is as important as all the money you can give to them.
The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is guided by the belief that every life has equal value. And I spoke with Dr. Valerie Ninkamgang-Bemo from the Foundation's Emergency Response Team. She was in Dubai for the DIHAD, the Dubai International Humanitarian Aid and Development Conference and Exhibition. We pick up the conversation now. I wanted to come back on what you were talking about before, Dr. Valerie, and love and forgiveness. We use that word humanitarian, and we can use that quite freely, sadly, because of what's happening in the world today. But to understand that, you know, I'm from the United Kingdom, you're from Cameroon, but are our needs the same? We may have had different experiences, but as human beings across the globe, are we all the same?
I'll say yes. We have the same blood circulating in our vein. We have the same need. We have the same need for love. Unfortunately, a lot of people have less the basic to survive than they are. Some people are in the survival mode when others have that basic covered. And I think that is where the difference, but it should not be different in life. And as you mentioned, one thing I really learned a lot of about being in the more difficult places where sometimes people have lost everything even loved one. One thing that amazed me is that they give me more than I gave to them. They are ready to share. They have so much hope. They are so much, just a smile. And they're happy to be just alive. And sometimes when I have to be complaining about something not going well in my luxury, I would call it luxury, even if I'm not so luxury, but in my day-to-life, I have to remind myself about, do I have right to be complaining? I can wake up every morning having a place to sleep, having food, having a toilet, having a water to take a shower, be able to go to work every day. This is luxury, and I have to be grateful to God every day that I'm waking up, and I don't give myself right to be mad and not be happy. And I think one thing that we talk about humanity, we saw people, like you said, around the world, like from Greece. I was 3-4 months ago, I was in Greece looking at the boats arriving. These people are like you, like me, who have a lot of hope, who have a lot of dream. I think what is important is that, like everybody, we have a lot of dream. And every parent always want the best for their kids. And they will do everything that they can to get their kids in the safe place, to provide for them. When that capacity is exhausted, it can be difficult. If you're a parent and you know you can't feed your kid, you can't give him a roof, it can be difficult. And I think that is where the humanity can come, but with a lot of compassion, to understand that this guy, as any of us, will always have dream, and they still have dream. What is amazing is that they still have dream, and their hope is not fading, and that is what keeps them alive. And how do we help them with their dream, to make their dream and to make them know that they're still human and they can still survive, and there's always hope ahead of them. And this for me is the best thing. I've been visiting a lot of them, and sometimes it's amazing people. You come, they have nothing, but they are willing to share even the small bread they have. They have not had food for 2-3 days, and they have a piece of bread. They say, come, sit down, share the bread with me. That is amazing. One day I went to a camp, and I saw one of a man, and he was like, I said, wow, you look happy. He said, I'm so happy. I said, what makes you feel so happy? He said, I'm so lucky, I'm so happy. And he was staying in this tent, like, I don't even know how many, maybe 10 square feet with 6 people of his family.
This is a refugee camp.
It was a refugee camp. And you're like, wow, what's it? He said, you know, a lot of other families, nobody from all my kids are alive, and I have them around me. My wife is here. I have a place I can sleep, and I have some small providing of food. Is it not that I'm lucky? Is it not that I'm grateful? What do I have else to not be happy, and I'm alive, and all of us are healthy? And you sit down and you're like, this is a lesson of life. This is a life lesson for all of us to understand that sometimes it takes just a simplicity to be happy, and the happiness is not always with what you have as a material, but what you are inside and what the love you have around you. And this is what I learned being around them all the time.
What's one of the worst things you've seen?
I have a lot of experience, but I think one of them that I want to share, multiple years ago, I think in 2005, I was in Chad, where you have the refugees from Darfur coming, and this was really at the beginning of the crossing with the bad condition, and they are in camp that we don't even know how long. And we set their health facilities, health clinic, to take care of it. And one day I'm going to the camp, and I see one of the tents, like a flame going on the tents. And people start going and say, what is going on? They say, oh, a tent that is burning. And we all rush there with the car and things like that. And I get there, I see people shout. I didn't understand what they were saying, shouting, crying. And I said, what's going on? And I push everybody. I said, let me pass. And I saw a lady that was sitting there. And in the tent was on fire. And I trying to why people don't take her? Then I take a piece of cloth that I have, I throw on her, and I start to want to pull her. And I realized she was chained. on the pole, on the tent, with a really like chain. And I like, what is going on? And I asked, where is the key? Find me something to open that thing. But in the meantime, the things were burning and I almost burned myself. Finally, from anywhere, we don't know how it came, but somebody came and opened the chain, the lock, and we took her in the car really rapidly and drove to the hospital. She was almost burned, like, you know, the skin become white, and we tried to take a line. She was still alive. We tried to take a line, we couldn't because she was almost burned. We reached to the hospital, I think with her mom. We reached to the hospital, they tried everything. I think 12 hours later, it was like only the internal organ that was still okay. The rest were completely burned externally. But the story, this was a young girl of 17 years old that were coming from Sudan, and her father tried to, she was 16 actually, trying to force her to marriage, apparently to a man who was 60 years old. And she, the first time she said she don't want, the parents still do that. Then they put her to the man and she escaped one, two times. And then the father was so mad that he decided to chain her so that she cannot escape, to force her. And then she decided that if she preferred not be alive, then go in something false. And she sent some kid buying some fuel and then some matches. And she just decided to put fire. She did intentionally put the fire because she said she rather die than accepting that. And it was in a way sad, because I was in the car and you can smell the burning and we have to drive for 30 minutes and we were trying to put a line and a vein in the car, in the ambulance. This was just terrible. But I was also amazed by the courage of that young lady who decided that her freedom is more important than even her life. And she, sad that she died, but I think I was amazed by her courage. And then the father was so sad, the mom were crying, the father, we tried to arrest him and things like that. He asked, and the old man who wanted her decided that he would never take anymore. It was a sad story, but at the end, what I remind me is that the courage of these people, despite everything, this young girl still have dreams. It was in the middle of nowhere. They didn't know what was life, but she was actually would have been doing a good for their family, because that old man would have given money to the family to survive. But she were still hope and dream of having love in her life. It's just courageous. And I always have remember the smell, the face, but remind me about why they are fighting. And that is still a lot of love and courage despite losing everything.
Dr. Valerie is a native of Cameroon, living now in the United States. But I asked her about growing up in Cameroon and why she chose to go into the medical field.
I think I always wanted to do that. Since I remember being 5 years or 6 years old, and I don't know why. I was lucky enough to be born in a family that was a kind of middle and high family, where my two parents come from really large families. And from my father's side, my father was maybe the only educated person, but really believe in education. And he told us all the time that you can do everything you want and they will be there to support us with everything you want. And my mom was a social worker working in the health clinic. And really early, even with my school break, I was going and sitting there and see all the kids. And I like, I want to help people. I want to do that. Then as I remember, since I can remember asking for toys, I always have a stethoscope or thing. When everybody were sick, I was always the one there helping them with it. And it's been always been a dream for me to help people. And I was lucky that I have parents that make my dream happening and supporting me as much as I can to make it happen. And I never, you know, even when I was 12 years old, I remember I was looking at TVs and see all these doctors in Without Border in the middle of nowhere. And I was like, oh, this is what I want. But of course, everybody discouraged me. No, this is not for women. You should not do that. You should be just a normal doctor and think this is not good for you. And of course, I push it away and I decided that it was not good for me until maybe 10 years or after I got a degree. Then I was approached by MSF. And then that dream of me, the 12 years old, came back to like, oh, I always wanted to do that. Of course, a lot of my friends and family were not happy for me to start going in the middle of nowhere. And they're like, you know, you're so brilliant. You always have been the best of your promotion. My colleague, my professor, they were so mad that I did, because they were calling it a waste instead of sitting. And I could have had a lot of big clinic and much more money. And I'm like, it's not about money. I never done it because I wanted to have money. Then I decided to start with MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières, and in the middle of nowhere. And I say the worst case is like, I don't like it, and I go back to my practice, but I may like it. And after a month being there, it's like, this is exactly why I always done that. And I never go back to normal practice. I always went to this type of practice in the crazy places in the world.
But you're in danger at times, and also what you're experiencing and what you're seeing. I know you're a professional, but you're a human being as well. So how do you manage that? Do you get counseled? Who takes care of you? Who cares for the carer?
I think one thing is true, we have danger, but fortunately a lot of organizations are a bit better in that, to have always somebody in the team that take care of the people. And then for some of the difficult mission, they don't allow you to stay too long, and there's a lot of way to pull you out. But at the end, you have to take care of yourself. And it's a point, yeah, it's true, I burn out myself in some point, because it's hard, it's difficult, and sometimes you even feel guilty going to sleep. You feel guilty having a weekend, because you're like, how can I be sleeping or having a weekend when so many people need help and are not sleeping or are dying? I can't. But one thing you have to remember is that you can only give what you have. And if you are not rested, if you are not full on yourself, actually you can be a harm for them. And they don't need a double harm. They don't need to be suffering twice. And also one thing I also learned is that when people are really in difficult period, the last thing they want is somebody who come and cry, who cry as well. They want you to come, because that is what gives them hope, to come with a fresh smile and show them that this is better than just crying. And we tend to go opposite and be in the sad way, dressing badly, and that is not what they want. Then you have to realize that in order to help, you need to be stable yourself. You need to be well yourself, because don't go. And I think it's important in all team to always check in each other to make sure that I've been in a team. A lot of the time I was unfortunately be the one taking care of a lot of the people. And sometimes I have to pull them out, force them. Of course, they are reluctant because they feel like they are failing. But if you see they are start be a danger for you, for their team, and for themselves, you have to pull them out. And it's difficult. And you understand where they're coming from. But yeah. And security, you have to be careful. You have to always use your gut. You have to not take unnecessary risk. And then to just sometimes follow in your instinct. A lot of time it saved me, following your instinct, just seeing something is not right and just don't go. And yeah.
For those people you come across who will think, I don't know that world. I don't know, when I see pictures of refugees or I see people in famine or in poverty or people that are in crisis or after a disaster, that I have to take care of my own family where I am, and that doesn't mean anything to me because that's in another country or somewhere else. How do you deal with that, having experienced firsthand what you've experienced?
What I try to do is to put them in real life situation. I remember sometimes I say, oh, imagine you are sitting here and they call you and say, your house burned. Simple. What is your first thought? They say, oh, I want to see if my children are okay with everything. I say, okay, your children are safe. What is the thing? Oh, my goodness, my pictures, my mom stuff. What do I sleep tonight? What do I wear? I have all my belongings there. Then I have to bring them to that reality of like, and then I say after the first day, okay, your neighbor, oh, my neighbor, maybe come and give me food. And I say, how long can you survive with the neighbor coming and give you plate? They're like, okay, you know, bring them to say, this is what people in the worst case, because maybe you still have a job, maybe you have insurance, maybe you have a bank, but imagine the same situation where all the system is completely destroyed. That means that you don't even have a job anymore. You can't even drive. The insurance doesn't work. This is what people have in multiple. Then put them in the situation of a simple things like you just lost your house, it's burned, or, and have them understand that it's not about the people or that, it's about your kids, your family is safe. Can I communicate? Do I miss my simple belonging? And sometimes it's not money. Imagine a photo of your mom and your mom are gone, or something your mom left you, the only, and it's burned. You, no matter how much money, you'll never have it. And that feeling, people start looking at it and say, I never thought about that. And I think this for me is the best way to, because, and it's true, you can't, it's difficult to relate with all the images. Even me who have done so many emergencies, so many places, when I went to Greece and see boats arriving and holding them, no matter how much, it was disturbed. It was really, no matter how much images or video I saw, be there myself and having people hug you, crying, smiling, be wet, see the danger and be like, oh my goodness, I made it. It's a completely different experience. Of course, everybody cannot go there, but just remember, near us, everywhere, we have people in need that are in the, you just have to go in your neighborhood in the corner and you'll find the same type of people. Unfortunately, even with the heavy system in US, in Europe that we have, you still have that. Then I think at the end, like I said, everybody needs love. Every parent loves their kids, want to provide for the, every father want to provide for their family, want to give a roof, want to give education, want their kids to get married, to succeed. This is what is the basic of us being human. And suddenly something out of their control just make that nothing of that possible. But they still have to keep believing and they still have to keep hope. And I just feel that it's courageous for them.
Thank you to Dr. Valerie. We've posted details of the Gates Foundation up on the Dubai Today blog post and connected to Facebook. So check out DubaiEye at 1038.com.